Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present journalist and author Robert Dreyfuss, who discusses his investigation into recent challenges to the powerful American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. Michael Kodas, a fellow in environmental journalism at the University of Colorado, who talks about ways in which climate change has increased the danger of forest fires across the U.S. and the world. And Nicolette Han Nyman, a cattle rancher and environmentalist, who talks about the origin of swine flu and the danger she sees posed to public health by factory farming. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A massive water shortage has hit southern Iraq that threatens to leave 2 million Iraqis without electricity or safe drinking water. Power supplies in Iraq's fourth largest city, Nasiriyah, were cut by 50% in August due to rapidly falling levels in the Euphrates River. Civil engineers fear that if river water levels continue to drop, it could force the city's two remaining electric turbines to shut down. These conditions are boosting salt levels in towns on the Persian Gulf near Basra, causing a depletion of drinking water supplies. According to the Guardian newspaper, the water crisis comes after 2 years of severe drought, combined with 6 years of civil conflict and neglect of agricultural lands. It has caused a fall-off in the production of local fruit and vegetables. The crisis has also affected migrant marsh Arabs in southern Iraq, where over 300,000 people have fled the marshes as river water has dried up. This August, more than 8,000 people lined up in a baseball stadium in Inglewood, California, to see volunteer doctors for a health checkup. This was the first healthcare event offered in a major city by the grassroots health organization Remote Area Medical. The group's founder, Ed Brock, noted, "The people came here because they were in pain." According to the American Prospect magazine, the event showcased the little-discussed racial element in the debate over health care reform. Non-whites make up a majority of the 47 million Americans without health coverage. Latinos currently make up the largest uninsured group. In addition to the fact that children born to black women are twice as likely to die in their first year as babies born to white women, blacks are more likely to suffer from chronic diseases like diabetes, cancer, or heart disease, and have less access to state-of-the-art treatment. So far, President Obama has not placed the fight for health care reform in the context of racial equality. Instead, Obama has focused on universal access and cost control. In contrast, the right-wing opponents of health reform have been more than willing to play the race card. An editorial in the conservative Investor's Business Daily labeled Obama's health plan affirmative action on steroids, a theme picked up by right-wing talk show hosts like Glenn Beck. Fast food worker Antonio de la Cruz was fired from Kentucky Fried Chicken in Chicago this past June because his name and social security number were not found on a government database. De la Cruz had worked for KFC for 10 years. According to the news magazine In These Times, Cruz was among 200 immigrant workers fired in Chicago and Madison, Wisconsin, by Yum Brands, a fast food company that owns KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell. The workers had all received no-match letters from the Social Security Administration. 2 years ago, the Bush administration allowed employers to use no-match letters to fire workers who could not resolve the discrepancy between their name and Social Security number within 90 days. But a federal judge struck down the policy, and the Obama administration has let the matter drop. Worker advocates are pressuring Yum Brands restaurants to stop the firings. Leone Jose Bicchieri of the Chicago Workers Collaborative believes Yum Brands is only test marketing its strategy of firing workers with no match letters to gauge public reaction. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, is one of the most powerful lobby groups in the U.S. today. Since its founding, the committee has had a profound influence on Washington's foreign policy as it relates to Israel and the Middle East. With 100,000 members, an annual budget of $60 million, and a staff of 300, AIPAC has very few rivals. Members of Congress are eager to toe the organization's line, knowing that the group is very skilled at influencing where strategic campaign contributions are made in key election races. 31 PACs with unofficial ties to AIPAC contributed more than $22 million in the 2008 election cycle. The controversial 2007 book titled The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy by John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt, political science professors at the University of Chicago and Harvard, respectively, explored how pro-Israel groups have shaped U.S. foreign policy. The authors contend that AIPAC and other Israel lobby groups have pressured the United States to adopt policies that are neither in America's national interest nor Israel's long-term interest. But in his recent Mother Jones magazine article titled Still the Chosen One, journalist and author Robert Dreyfus investigated a possible decline in AIPAC's influence on Capitol Hill. The most important change, Dreyfus points out, is the election of Barack Obama, who came to office with the stated goal of engaging America's foes in the Middle East and to push for a sustainable Israeli-Palestinian peace accord. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Dreyfus about the forces that have emerged to challenge AIPAC's power.
What you're seeing is a problem for AIPAC, which truly has been one of the most powerful lobbies in Washington, certainly more powerful than some of the others that you might think of, like the American Medical Association or the National Rifle Association, or AARP, which I guess would be the other big three lobby groups. AIPAC really stands alone and has been very, very important for at least 30 years. But it's important to point out that they've lost some battles when a president has been determined to make a change in policy. They lost the battle against President Reagan, who wanted to sell AWACS aircraft, that is, radar aircraft, to Saudi Arabia, and that was opposed by AIPAC back in the early 1980s. And then in the late 80s, again against the Republican president, they clashed with President Bush the First and James Baker, the Secretary of State, and they lost that battle as well. Now, you might say these were somewhat skirmishes, and what Obama is after is really the big battle, which is to get Israel to withdraw from the occupied territory in the West Bank and to allow the creation of a Palestinian state, which the current prime minister of Israel says that he's against. So I think on both Israel and Iran, we're kind of heading for something of a showdown, either later this year or early next year.
Why is AIPAC so influential on U.S. Middle East policy?
Part of the reason is that people are afraid to criticize them, because when you do, you're usually branded anti-Semitic, which is, of course, ridiculous. Many of the critics of Israel's policies in the West Bank and in the occupied territories are Jews themselves. And in fact, three-quarters of American Jews voted for Obama. So he won overwhelming support among American Jews. But AIPAC is considered important and powerful because it is important and powerful. It has a $70 million budget. It's got offices all over the country and an army of lobbyists. And it makes a lot of noise when any issue comes before Congress and increasingly even before the executive branch, trying to intimidate or bully the members of Congress or members of the administration. And what's happened recently, and this is really too early to say that it's decisive, but a number of other organizations are emerging of pro-Israel groups that are also on the liberal left side of the spectrum. They call themselves pro-peace, groups like J Street, which have established themselves as lobbyists against AIPAC and for Israel, but for a different vision of the kind of Israel that can have sustainable security and which is not constantly at war with the Palestinians and the rest of the Arab world.
What is the future for these alternative lobby groups relating to Israel, like J Street and the Israeli Policy Forum? Do you think these folks will be gaining more power in Washington, D.C. to influence events at the expense of AIPAC?
Well, they may gain more power. They may expand. They may get more support. I think right now they're playing a different role. It isn't so much that they're lobbying to accomplish this or that. They're providing cover for members of Congress who would otherwise be probably supporting the AIPAC view, but who can now say, but what I'm proposing is something that these other pro-Israel groups are strongly supportive of. And so it gives some, you know, breathing room to members of Congress who might want to say, you know, let's do something different so that they can't be accused of being anti-Israel. And so they're playing a very important role in that regard. And I think as a result of that, they're likely to get more support from liberal American Jews in particular, who see their role as something important. And that's exactly who they're appealing to for their financial contributions and donors and so forth.
That was investigative journalist Robert Dreyfus, author of the book Devil's Game, How the U.S. Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Read his article on AIPAC at motherjones.com or visit his website at robertdreyfus.com. As California and other western states cope with larger and more frequent forest fires, such as the Station Fire outside Los Angeles that has consumed hundreds of square miles, experts in the field are paying closer attention to the link between forest fires and global warming. In the last 3 decades, the wildfire season in the western U.S. has increased by 78 days, and burn durations of large fires have increased fivefold to 37 days. This is occurring at the same time that temperatures have increased over 1 degree Fahrenheit. Since 2000, wildland fires in the United States have burned an average of more than 7 million acres a year, about double the average acreage for the previous 4 decades. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Michael Kotas, a former reporter and photographer with the Hartford Courant, who spent the 2003 fire season battling blazes in Colorado and Wyoming in order to write a news article about the experience. He is currently a Ted Scripps Fellow in Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado, looking at the relationship between forest fires and climate change. Kotas discusses various ways in which climate change has increased the danger of forest fires, from drought to the changed behavior of insects, as well as the human element in the equation.
There are a number of issues with related to climate change. Now, obviously, there are a lot of people that have differing opinions about how much climate change is caused by people, but particularly in the case of forest fire and the most recent forest fires, it's undeniable that intense drought, in the case of the California fires, they've been in a drought situation for a decade. And unprecedented hot temperatures have contributed heavily to the fires, and that's not just the case in the United States. That was a big part of what contributed to the really horrible fires in Australia last winter, or at least the winter here in the Northern Hemisphere.
You're saying it's connected to drought, but then how is drought connected to climate change?
Well, the increased temperatures brought on by global warming, there's other things that really contribute to it as well. With the climate change, the snowpack in mountains is reduced quite a bit, which has lengthened the fire seasons because the spring runoff is now shorter. There's not as much snow to melt. So that's both contributed to drought and also increased the length of the fire season pretty much throughout the western United States. As far as looking at deeper at how climate change is influencing forest fire, a lot of foresters and fire experts right now are concerned that there's something of a feedback loop that's been created, where forests, when they burn, put out the gases that contribute to climate change, and then the changing climate causes drought and also other problems such as encouraging certain forest pests that kill trees and make them more vulnerable to fire. You have an increase in fire that puts out an increase in the global warming gases and makes the whole situation worse. A According to a Brookings Institution report last year, actually, forest fires put out more climate-warming gases than all of the fuel that passed through the Alaska pipelines that year. So people don't often think of forest fires contributing that much global warming gas, but they can. And by some measures, are putting out 20% of the global warming gases.
I've read that deforestation contributes 20% to climate change, and some of that is through burning, but certainly not all. Is that the same data you're referring to?
No, this was 20% just from fire. But it is fire, it is counting fire that contributes to deforestation, or that's, you know, man-made fire that is used in, say, slash and burn agriculture.
Michael Kotis, how do you measure an increase in forest fires? Is it in intensity, in acres burned, in the days that the burning goes on?
You can measure all of those things, but the biggest measure in the United States has been by acreage burned. And if you look back over the last century, you'll see that we had very large fires a century ago. And in fact, a very famous fire called the Big Blow-Up occurred 100 years ago next year in 2010. And that was the fire that prompted the U.S. government to really get heavily involved in managing forest fires. And for a period of time after that, the acreage burned was substantially lower than it had been in the years before that. And we're now seeing in the past few decades, and in particularly the last 6 or 7 years, a marked increase in the size of fires again, so that they're as big as they were 100 years ago, except that this time we've got whole armies of firefighters and firefighting aircraft and other resources and technology that are trying to suppress them, but not having the level of success that they once did.
Do people in the field talk about the need to address global warming in order to keep this from becoming a bigger and bigger problem? Or do they talk about other things, like maybe people not building houses with shake roofs in the middle of a forest?
You bring up a good point. Most fire managers are, certainly look at climate change and are concerned about it, but it's not something that they have a lot of control over other than trying to, fight fires and keep them from contributing what greenhouse gases they do contribute. However, there are other contributing factors that the Forest Service and other land managers are very heavily involved in, and you brought up two. The two biggest concerns are, first is that during that period of time that the U.S. government has really been fighting forest fires, because they suppress so many fires, they have allowed a huge buildup of fuel in the forest, so that the natural fire cycle was interrupted, and the forests that would have burned in the natural cycle every decade or two, some of them haven't burned in almost 100 years. And so that's just allowed fuel to burn, to build up in those forests, making them far more explosive than they would have been had the natural fire cycle been allowed to just continue. The second problem is that we've also introduced a huge new type of fuel into the forest, which is development. About half of the development from statistics I've seen in the past decade in the Pacific states has been in what's known as the wildland-urban interface, which is the area where development meets wild lands that are generally considered flammable.
That was Michael Kotis, a Ted Scripps Fellow in Environmental Journalism at the University of Colorado. Visit his website at michaelkotis.com. As the United States and other nations around the world brace for what many scientists say could be a severe outbreak of the swine flu or H1N1 influenza strain this fall and winter, the more than 2,200 students at Washington State University who contracted swine flu in the first week of September may be an early indicator of what's likely to come. Delays in the production of H1N1 vaccine could complicate the U.S. Center for Disease Control's notice advising pregnant women, children, and other high-risk patients to be vaccinated. Federal officials reported on September 4th that at least 36 children have died in the U.S. as a result of the current swine flu pandemic. There is speculation that the origin of the disease may be connected to Carroll Farms, a huge factory hog farm located in Veracruz State, Mexico, co-owned by the U.S.-based corporation Smithfield Foods. In early March, local Mexican health officials issued an alert claiming that 60% of the residents of the town of Perote suffered from flu, pneumonia, and bronchitis, symptoms later associated with the current swine flu outbreak. The Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production cites the potential public health effects of concentrated animal feeding operations as including disease and the transmission of disease, the potential for the spread of pathogens from animals to humans. Nicolette Hahn Nyman is a cattle rancher, attorney, and environmentalist. Her husband, Bill Nyman, founded the Nyman Ranch, a natural meat company based in Northern California. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nicolette Nyman about the origin of swine flu and the danger she sees posed to public health by factory farming.
Both in avian influenza as well as in swine flu, it has been shown that there's a strong connection, not between just any farming in general, but specifically between operations where you have a lot of animals and they're closely confined and these flus. And the reason is because, I mean, it's actually very logical. It's very commonsensical. You have a lot of animals. They're very closely packed together. So there's a lot of transmission of any kind of disease between them. Their immune systems are very stressed by the environment because they don't have, I mean, if you just think about, you know, sort of when we all were growing up and our parents said, you know, go outside and get some fresh air and exercise, we kind of all know as common sense that that's something you need to do to stay healthy. And that's true for animals as well. And if you're always keeping them confined in a situation where they're never breathing fresh air and they're never able to exercise, their immune systems are not very strong. What happens with these viruses is they morph, they evolve as they go from host to host, so from individual to individual, whatever you're talking about, whether it's pigs or people or chickens. And they can become more and more virulent as they evolve. And so if you have a lot of animals together in one location, there's a lot more opportunity for that host-to-host transmission. And the conditions in these operations are, you know, quite frankly, I've been in a lot of them, and, you know, they're filthy, quite frankly. So it's just an environment where you have a lot of any kinds of diseases going from animal to animal. And so what happens is you build up these various different kinds of diseases, and these swine flus are one of the diseases that have come out, and these avian flus as well, of these operations. And there's very good scientific evidence that specifically links the current H1N1 virus to concentrated swine operations that are actually in the United States. The Mexican operation that you referenced may actually be the specific source. That's a Smithfield operation. That may be the specific source of this particular virus that hasn't been determined yet. But it is well known that more than 75% of the genetic characteristics of that virus were already appearing in North Carolina and other parts of the United States in swine operations. So, you know, this is not a stretch to connect the factory farming industry with swine flu and avian flu.
Nicolette, I've read reports where antibiotics have been found in sewage systems around the country and in bodies of water. Some of that is leaching in there from factory farms, others just by our consumption of foods with these antibiotics in them. In the long run, what is the danger for all of us just sitting at home consuming this food and being exposed to antibiotic-fed livestock as food?
Well, just in terms of the quantities, I think it's important to note that no one knows for sure how much antibiotics are being used in the livestock industry, the livestock and poultry industry, because the government does not require reporting of it to be made to the public. But the Union of Concerned Scientists, which is a very credible nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C., has spent a lot of time estimating how much is used in the livestock and poultry industry. And several years ago, they came out with a report that estimated that the total amount of antibiotics being fed to livestock and poultry was more than eight times the total amount used for all human illnesses in any given year. So we're talking about huge quantities being added to the feed of animals and poultry, of livestock and poultry. And the reason is because the conditions are so unsanitary that it basically is part of the way of keeping the animals alive. The United States Geological Survey, I think that's the study you were referencing, has sampled waterways throughout the country, and they did a kind of a couple of years of doing this, and they were discovering that there were all kinds of antibiotic residues and antibiotic bacteria in waterways all over the country and in very high levels. So the reason that that's a huge concern for all of us is because of the fact that, you know, diseases that were once fairly benign and were not, you know, necessarily that dangerous to humans are now becoming much more virulent. So they're more dangerous, and we don't have an ability to treat them with our existing medicines. Basically, what we're doing is we're, by overusing antibiotics in animal feed, we're taking our own ability as a human culture to treat these illnesses away, and we're increasing the number of times that people become exposed to these diseases.
What are some of the other models European nations and others have used to place more restrictions on the use of antibiotics and the whole model of factory farming?
Well, you know, Europe is, I mean, especially Western Europe, really is ahead of us on these issues. They have, quite a number of years ago, the European Union already adopted a ban on the practice of feeding antibiotics to livestock in routine feeding. Now, what's happening in the United States, there's a lot of political power within the meat industry. And I was just reading an article earlier today that said that there are now 20 meat industry groups that have banded together and are petitioning the Congress not to adopt a law that they're considering that's in front of them to outlaw, you know, some of this practices of feeding antibiotics routinely. For the meat industry, what antibiotic feeding represents is a way to reduce costs. And so it really comes down to, for them, it's an issue of economics. But for the rest of us, you know, for the public, it's really an issue of our health.
That was Nicolette Hahn-Nyman, a cattle rancher, attorney, and environmentalist. She is the author of The Righteous Pork Chop, Finding a Life and Good Food Beyond Factory Farms. Visit her website at righteousporkchop.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.